And I realized that what I did then would either set me up for wealth or for poverty. So I started learning everything I could, reading books. The first book I read was like in sixth grade, and it was The Motley Fool's Guide for Teens, How to Have More Money Than Your Parents Ever Dreamed Of.
Hey gang, welcome back. Episode number 133 of Future Proof. I say welcome back to our regular listeners, our subscribers, and if you are a subscriber, well, hey, thanks. tell your friends. The more the merrier, right? And if this is your first go around with our little show here, well, then just welcome, I guess. Glad you're here. I hope this is everything you imagined it would be and more. How about that? That's a tall order, but hey, you know, we're here to serve, right? I'm Bill Sheridan, by the way. I'm your host. A quick tip of the hat to our sponsor this week. That would be the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses, dozens of instructors, and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. So this week's show, it's all about taking control, taking aggressive control, actually, of your finances, specifically your personal finances. And what, you might be asking, does that have to do with becoming future ready? To which I'll reply, what? Are you kidding me? I mean, unless you've been independently wealthy for years and years and years, this conversation is all about future proofing your life. I mean, check this out, okay? In their book, The Future is Faster Than You Think, this is just one example, right? Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler, the authors, they point out that exponential advances in technology might be on the verge of helping us live significantly longer lives. And they quote inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil here. And here's what they write. They say that Kurzweil, quote, often discusses the concept of longevity escape velocity, or that is the point at which science can extend your life for more than a year for every year that you are alive. And as far future as this sounds, according to Kurzweil, we are a lot closer than you might expect. Quote, it's likely that we're just another 10 to 12 years away from the point that the general public will hit longevity escape velocity, Kurzweil said. End quote. Talk about mind-blowing there. And if you're wondering what all that has to do with your personal finances, ask yourself this. Have you saved enough money to enable yourself to live more than twice as long as you're expecting to? Yeah, I thought so. Me neither, right? So yeah, this is important stuff. And the sooner we start talking about this stuff and thinking about it, and I mean thinking hard about it, the better. I'm talking to you here, specifically, young professionals. This is from CNN Money's Ultimate Guide to Retirement. They ask the question, when should you start saving? And the answer is, and I'm quoting here, as soon as you can. Ideally, you'd start saving in your 20s when you first leave school and begin earning paychecks. That's because the sooner you begin saving, the more time your money has to grow. Each year's gains can generate their own gains the next year, a powerful wealth-building phenomenon known as compounding. And then the article goes on. It says, quote, here's an example of what a big difference starting young can make. Say you start at age 25 and put aside $3,000 a year in tax-deferred retirement accounts for 10 years. And then you stop saving completely, okay? So at age 35, you're not putting any more in. By the time you reach age 65, your $30,000 investment will have grown to more than $338,000. That's assuming a 7% annual return, even though you didn't contribute a dime beyond age 35. Now, let's say that you put off saving until you turn 35 and then save $3,000 a year for 30 years. By the time you reach age 65, you will have set aside $90,000 of your own money, but it will grow to only about $303,000, assuming the same 7% annual return. That's a huge difference, end quote. Duh, right? I mean, you gotta love compound interest, right? Albert Einstein called it the eighth wonder of the world and the most powerful force in the universe, end quote. And I kind of buy that, right? And of course, then comes the question, how much should you save? For that answer, here's Ron Lieber of the New York Times in an article entitled How to Win at Retirement Savings. He says the short answer is as much as you reasonably can. Okay. Lieber says, quote, sure, you'll see articles telling you you have to save at least 15% of your income. That's a fine benchmark, though the true number will depend on how long you hope to work, what kind of inheritance you might get, and a bunch of other unknowable facts. So start with something, even if it's just $25 per paycheck, and then try to save a little bit more each year. Do it early and often enough so that saving becomes second nature, end quote. So a lot of great advice out there, tons of it actually. And we've got some more for you here this week, courtesy of my guest. She is Rachel Richards. Rachel's story, a pretty incredible story actually, mainly through sheer will. Actually, she paid her way through college by selling Cutco knives, which I immediately connected with. Okay, Cutco's headquarters is located about 20 minutes from where I was born and raised in Western New York State. So kind of a cool connection there. But anyway, Rachel, because she did that, she graduated college with no debt, none at all. And not that long ago either, right? So next, after graduation, she took her love of helping people with their finances and her talent for sales. She decided to become a financial advisor. And while she was good at that job, her heart really wasn't into it. So she started looking for a way out. And that's when she stumbled into the world of investment properties. And she worked that until she was the ripe old age of 27. And that's when she quit her job and retired. Okay. While living off of the $15,000 a month in passive income that she earned from her 40 residential rental units. So, oh yeah. One other thing. She's the author of two books, best-selling books, by the way, one called Money Honey and the other called Passive Income, Aggressive Retirement. She's also written an online course entitled Get Your Financial Shit Together. And yeah, she definitely got hers together long before you did, I'm guessing, certainly long before I did. So I wanted to find out a little bit more about, you know, what lessons she's learned along the way, what advice she might offer young professionals as they begin their savings journey, right? And even what older savers like myself might be able to take away from her journey and apply it to our own, right? So really good stuff here. Very interesting conversation. A little advice for all of us as we try to prepare for our future financial lives. Here is my conversation with Rachel Richards. Rachel, where are you from originally?
I was born in Michigan and raised in Kentucky. So I spent the last 20 years of my life in Louisville, Kentucky before moving to Colorado in 2020.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about the move. Where in Michigan, by the way?
In the Detroit area.
Detroit area. Okay. What took you to Kentucky?
I only lived there for, I think, 5 weeks. So my dad's job kind of took us around and we left Michigan, but I have family in Michigan and Kentucky.
There you go. Okay. And you're settled now in Colorado?
Colorado Springs, but we're only here for 3 months. We are going to be traveling for the rest of the year and exploring the West.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. We being you and
my husband. Oh, yeah. Nice. And our dog.
There you go.
Yeah.
Speaking of family, what was family like for you growing up? Big family, brothers and sisters? What was that all like?
Yeah, I have an older and a younger sister. My family is very close. You know, we're friends. We're close friends. My parents are married. They've been married for over 30 years. They still are in Kentucky, but my sisters are out west now too.
Okay. Okay. Where did your money acumen come from? I mean, were you raised with that kind of, you know, respect for the almighty dollar? Or, I mean, how did that happen?
More so, I think, fear and stress around the dollar. Yeah. So, you know, my acumen came from a lot of different places, but when I was young, we grew up in this really wealthy county. And it was a very unrealistic bubble to grow up in. Just to give you an idea, some of the kids in my high school were getting brand new BMWs when they turned 16.
Wow.
Yeah, right. And my family was not operating that way. We weren't going on family trips, let alone even going out to eat at restaurants. Mm-hmm. We were always on a strict budget. So at a young age, I felt like I didn't fit in. And that's not the way you want to feel in middle school and in high school.
Right.
So I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to end up like everyone else struggling with money. I don't want to have to operate on a strict budget the rest of my life or borrow money from family and friends to make it to my next paycheck. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be different. And I realized that what I did then would either set me up for wealth or for poverty. So I started learning everything I could, reading books. The first book I read was like in sixth grade, and it was The Motley Fool's Guide for Teens, How to Have More Money Than Your Parents Ever Dreamed Of. And what kid doesn't want that? You know, that sounds awesome. So read everything I could. I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad in high school, and that's what turned me on to real estate investing. And really just, I was a total finance nerd, and I still am.
That's great. So this didn't necessarily come from, you know, any lessons that your parents passed down, but just your kind of general observations of what was going on around you and saying, that's not really what I want for myself.
Exactly. Just the desire to get ahead. And, you know, I think we grow up with a lot of the same beliefs and fears that our parents have, or just whatever context we're being raised in. So I had a lot of these limiting beliefs that money is always a source of stress. There's never enough money. And I had these fears of just never having enough money. And they say that fear can be paralyzing or motivating. Yep. Luckily for me, it was motivating. And it kind of spurred me on to want to learn everything I possibly could to get myself into a position of financial independence.
Yeah.
Because not only did I want to make sure I could take care of myself, but that I could take care of my loved ones if they needed help financially.
Right. That sounds like nirvana for most people would love to be there. What, I mean, were you one of those kids, you know, who had like four paper routes and started your own business when you were 14? I mean, how did that kind of, you know, from reading that book when you were in sixth grade, how did that build from there?
Yeah, I would say my entrepreneurialism didn't start until later, but it started in college because I was about to graduate high school and I had these fears of going into student debt. Because by then I knew this is something that impacts you forever. This can really be a disadvantage when you graduate. So I was like, how am I going to go to college and not take out student loans? Yeah. So I ended up selling Cutco cutlery. Have you heard of Cutco knives?
I was born and raised in Western New York, just outside of Olean.
Of Olean. So okay.
We're really familiar with Cutco. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Yes. So I found that opportunity. It was the first time I'd been exposed to something where the harder you work, the more money you make. And I had a work ethic that was unparalleled. So I knew I could make this work for me. I sold Cutco, I paid my way through school, and I graduated without debt at age 20.
Oh my God. That's like, I mean, walk me through that mindset there. I mean, was that just, again, working back from your fear of that student debt out of necessity? Obviously that work ethic was, let's take a step back from there. Where do you think that work ethic came from? I mean, was that kind of instilled in you by your parents, or how did that manifest itself?
I think it was both innate and instilled in me. Mm-hmm. I mean, they definitely expected me and my sisters to get all A's in school, and I was a straight A student. And it was just this expectation, like there wouldn't be any other way. We were just going to get straight A's. But, you know, I definitely was always a hard worker, perfectionist, type A, control freak. That's kind of my personality.
Right.
And I think it also just goes back to the fear. I am very debt averse, and I was that way even in high school. So looking forward to taking out, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of debt potentially in college, I mean, I just remember being so stressed about that, so anxious. Like that was the last thing I wanted to do. So that's what drove me to work as hard as I did. I just had this goal of graduating without debt and paying my way through school. And I was just single-mindedly focused on that. I wasn't going to let anything get in my way.
That work that you were doing for Cutco, was that a full-time job while you were going to school, or?
I mostly did it in the summers. I would sell a ton of knives. I would make about 10 grand each summer. There was one year, my senior year, that I was super bummed because I didn't make as much that summer as I thought. And so I ended up taking out a $5,000 loan senior year, but I was like, no, I am not graduating with this. So I sold around school I sold part-time around classes and I paid that off by the end of the fall semester.
What goes through your mind when you see what's going on today and read stories about just this explosion of student debt, kids going to college and graduating with, you know, a mountain of bills that they may never pay off? You know, I mean, what goes through your mind having gone through that experience yourself and done what you did to do it without debt? I mean, what do you think when you see this today?
It's just awful. I mean, to me, it's heartbreaking. I think very much it's predatory lending and taking advantage of 18-year-olds that really don't know what they're signing. And I do think you need to take ownership. You need to take responsibility for educating yourself before taking out a $50,000 loan. But, you know, there is a little bit of young people being taken advantage of. So it sucks. And I think people are finally waking up and realizing that a 4-year degree isn't the end all be all. People are finally starting to consider other options. Go to trade school, go to vocational school, go to a community college for the first 2 years, transfer your credits and get the degree from the private or the, you know, the public school or whatever it may be. So I think people are starting to realize it's not always worth it to do this. There needs to be a little bit of a cost analysis done, trying to project the ROI on that degree, which is pretty impossible to do.
Right.
But hopefully people will stop taking out so much debt to go get a degree that might end up to be almost worthless.
Yeah. And it's interesting. And I'm seeing more and more of this as well. Employers who have come right out and said, you know what, we're not going to require a 4-year degree for somebody. And in fact, large firms in our profession, right? Large accounting firms who have said, you know what, we don't necessarily require that degree anymore. We're going to go out and look for a specific type of person to fill this role, and, you know, degree be damned at this point. So it's kind of interesting to see that evolution, so to speak.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Advice for young folks from you as they kind of begin this financial journey, having gone through it yourself, knowing that not all of them are going to be able to do or are motivated to do what you did, but what's the one best piece of advice that you might give them as they're just getting out of the gates here?
I would just say don't make the assumption that you have to go to college. You don't have to do what other people are doing. You can like forge your own way, forge your own path. So, you know, sometimes I just like to look at what other people are doing and think, I'm going to do the opposite of what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to invest in real estate at a young age. I'm going to not take out loans for college. And a lot of those choices have ended up being really great in the long run. So I think when you follow this, you know, mass mindset, do what everyone else is doing, that's not always the right thing. So just taking a step back and asking yourself, well, why really am I doing this? Why is everyone else doing this? And does something else work better for me in the long run?
And it's really kind of interesting too, with advances, especially like in technology, where things are going. You know, I've heard more and more thought leaders say that kids, high school kids, maybe kids in junior high, will end up working in jobs that don't currently exist. Right. So, So how do you plan for that? How do you try to earn a 4-year degree for something that you don't even know is going to exist 4 years from now? So yeah, that mindset, I think that whole student mindset is changing kind of as we speak, really.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. And I don't mean to say college is bad. I mean, certainly a 4-year degree is important for some things, medical, you know, law degree, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's just not always the go-to answer anymore. I think times are finally changing.
So you spent some time as a financial advisor. Was that right out of college, or tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Yes, it was right after college. So my thought was, I have this passion for finance and I have this really strong sales background from selling Cutco. So a financial advising job would be perfect for me. So I took a job, and you know, you can picture me, a 21-year-old woman telling 70-year-olds how to invest their life savings. I mean, it was fun. I really actually didn't get as much pushback as I thought. I'm a pretty assertive woman, so I think people could sense that I knew what I was doing and I was confident. But what I didn't realize is that I was good at selling, but that didn't translate into a passion for selling. Mm-hmm. So when you're starting out as a financial advisor, you're prospecting, building a book of business. And I could have gotten to the point, I'm sure, after 10 years where I was spending most of my time helping people.
Right.
But when you start out, it's 99% of the time you're just cold calling. And I just didn't have enough passion for that to see myself doing that for the next 2 or 3 or 5 years. So I realized it wasn't going to work for me. I still wanted to make an impact and help people learn about money and investing. I didn't know how to do it at the time, but I knew that wasn't the right fit for me. So I did that for about a year and then I moved on.
So from the time that you spent there, from a financial advice, I guess, mindset or point of view, what kind of lessons did you learn while you were doing that type of work?
I learned a lot. Actually, the most eye-opening thing for me was to learn about how financial advisors are paid. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will hire a financial advisor not even knowing to ask this question, not even knowing to ask, well, how are you paid? Hmm. Because there are a couple different ways. Some advisors are paid based on commissions. So they're being paid based on products that they sell to you or investment recommendations that they make. That's not always in the client's best interest. They're not always acting in a fiduciary capacity. So I thought that was pretty interesting, and I never wanted to have a conflict of interest with my clients, so I chose to be a fee-only advisor. And now it's something that I try to educate people about and say, look, you need to understand how advisors are paid and make sure they're being paid in a way that aligns with your interests. So I chose to be that way, and now it's something that I think that other people should look for in an advisor.
Well, that's interesting because one of the things I was going to ask is, as a former financial advisor, what kind of advice would you give to financial advisors today? I mean, what did you learn during your time there that you think that they might be well off focusing on that maybe they're not focusing on right now? What kind of advice would you give?
There's so many things I learned. I could go on and on. But one thing is, I think we take for granted how much people actually know about investing. Mm-hmm. So I think we assume there's this level of knowledge, you know, if a married couple comes in, husband and wife, we assume there's this level of knowledge, particularly of the man, but that might not be there at all. So a lot of the times as an FA, you could just be totally talking over someone's head. And I know it's impressive to use this fancy terminology, but at the end of the day, if your clients don't understand a word that you're saying, you're not helping them. So it's kind of figuring out, well, how much do they know? How much do I need to be educating them? Because I truly think if you approach your job as an educator instead of a salesperson, both you and your client will come out better. So that's just a few things that I learned as a financial advisor.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And of course, now you made that transition to investing. And tell me a little bit about that transition. When did you decide, hey, this is where I want to be, and this is going to be a good financial move for me?
My husband and I started investing in real estate in 2017. I had been investing in the stock market since I was 18. So I was always doing that on the side, you know, getting our retirement accounts invested. But in 2017, we finally bought our first duplex in Louisville, Kentucky. So we were generating rental income for the first time. Later that year is when I launched my first best-selling book, Money Honey. Mm-hmm. So we had our focus from then on became all about passive income. We had these two passive income streams, rental income and royalty income, and we focused on growing those as much as we possibly could. And now we're making about 15 grand a month in passive income. We're financially independent. We're, you know, quote unquote retired, and we are able to spend our time doing what we want to do now.
Which is what? I mean, what are you focusing on now that you've kind of built that passive income and are allowing yourself to do things that you want to do? What are you focusing on?
There's a lot. Well, we're really into hiking. That's part of the reason we moved to Colorado. We love to travel, so that's why we're going to spend the rest of the year traveling. But I am so fortunate that I've actually started this business of teaching women about financial literacy, and it is truly the most fulfilling thing for me. So a lot of people are like, well, Rachel, you're not retired. You're still working. And yes, I am absolutely still working, but I'm working because I want to, not because I have to. So this is what brings me joy. This is what I'm passionate about, and I just want to keep spreading financial literacy.
So a couple of questions related to that. You said your passion is kind of teaching women how to be a little bit more financially literate. What areas are you seeing where they need to focus more, or where there might be problems, or what kind of advice would you offer folks as they're kind of moving into that journey? And it could be anything from, I mean, certainly we've been talking about investing advice, or where do you think people ought to be focused right now?
I see women having a couple different struggles. First, just not knowing where to begin, not having the knowledge. And you know what? It's not their fault. We are in a financial education crisis. At no point in our lives are we taught how to manage our money. And then we're left as young adults trying to figure it out all on our own. And unfortunately, the women, I think more so than the men, but I can't speak for men, but I see so many women have these feelings of guilt, shame, embarrassment when it comes to their money, which is unfortunate because they just weren't given the resources they need to succeed. Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes millennials, you know, we have the stereotype of being lazy, being entitled, but the women that I see and that want to learn from me, these are women that are ambitious. They're not comfortable with the fact that they don't know anything about money management. They don't like that. They want to learn. They just need someone to give them the resources in a way that's easy to understand. Because you know what? Finance is boring. Personal finance is dry. It's complex. It's intimidating. That's why I think my book, Money Honey, has hit such a nerve with female millennials because it makes this topic sassy and fun and simple. And I think as a financial advisor, if you can figure out a way to educate and just make things easy to understand, you can start reaching a whole new generation of people that do want to invest their money. They do want to learn with you and they can become your long-term clients.
Well, I mean, you make a good point about, you know, we're in a financial education crisis. As I look back on, and this is years ago now, but you know, my schooling, and I was never taught any of that. And I think that's pretty much par for the course that you know, personal finance is just not baked into any of our educational structure. And how does that, I don't even know what the question is here. I mean, where do we start with this type of financial education to kind of overcome that crisis that you're talking about? Where does that type of education need to start?
Yeah, it's tough because right now I feel like it's just self-education. It's kind of everyone to their own. Because yes, there's a lot of expectations that your parents should teach you, but not everyone has parents. Not everyone has financially literate parents or parents that are around that can help them. So I think it's unfair to rely on them. And then what needs to happen is it needs to be a program in middle school, in high school, and in all public education. There's too much emphasis on theoretical and not enough on practical. We need to teach young people things about how to track your expenses, how to have a budget, how credit cards work, how to change your oil in your car, how health insurance works, all these different topics. These are the things that adults struggle with and need help with.
It's almost like it's got to become a requirement of some sort at some point down the line in terms of earning a degree somewhere. We've got to, I mean, these are basic life skills, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed in your story is that you've stressed this point over and over again, and that's to start early, especially when it comes to investing and that type of thing. And that's one of the problems, right? I mean, there are tons of people my age, 45, 50, 55 and older, who have little or no retirement savings, and the clock is ticking, right, for these people. What kind of advice would you give people, you know, my age or later who didn't start early and are finding themselves in that boat? How can we start to prepare ourselves for that inevitable day when we're going to retire and we're going to need that money?
I had this belief when I was pretty young that, you know, it was very intimidating to invest in the stock market. It was a very scary thing. I didn't know what I was doing. And if I didn't know what I was doing, then surely I was going to lose all of my money. So here's what I try to emphasize with young people is that knowledge and money are not your biggest advantage when it comes to investing. Time is your biggest advantage. Yep. Even if you don't have a ton of money and you make mistakes, you will still be better off than an expert investor who waits 10 years from now to start investing. Mm-hmm. So it's just getting over that initial fear. Even if you just start with $100 or $200 and invest it in an index fund and just start to get a feel for how it works, you will be better off having done that today than having waited 5 years so you can learn everything that you can possibly learn about stock market investing. And if you are super scared to take that initial step, then use one of these stock market simulations. There's a good one there's a few good ones online. I'm blanking right now, but there's a few simulations where you can sign up for free. They give you like fake money. It's like virtual fake money. You can invest it and just get a feel for it. And it simulates a real investing experience. Mm-hmm. And that can help you get some of that comfort that you need to actually do it in real life.
So the lesson here is that, I mean, no matter where you are in the savings spectrum, it's better to get started now than tomorrow, basically.
Absolutely. And especially if you're somebody that has access to a 401k and an employer match, you better be contributing enough to get, you know, take full advantage of that employer match. And even if you don't have one, but you have earned income, you can open an IRA when you're 18. You can open a traditional Roth IRA. You don't have to max it out every single year, especially when you're 18, you might not have income. But even if you get something invested, that is going to set you off on the right foot.
If you could focus in on one thing that you could take out of everything that you've experienced, right? What's the biggest lesson you've learned on this journey?
I would say the biggest lesson is really about the way we approach retirement. The way we've traditionally approached retirement is something I call the nest egg theory. Mm-hmm. We work a 9-to-5 job for 40 years. We try to save up this huge nest egg so that we can live off of that for the rest of our lives and retire. And what I have noticed in my research is that while that used to work really well, times have changed drastically, and the way we've approached retirement really hasn't changed at all. Mm-hmm. That's why we're starting to run into this crisis of people not having enough money and, you know, people being 55 and having 50 grand in savings and nothing else. That's why we're starting to run into that. Because when you think about it, A, the cost of college has ballooned, placing an enormous burden on my generation. Mm-hmm. B, pensions are pretty much a thing of the past. We don't really have access to those anymore. And the most alarming thing, C, is that the Social Security Trust Fund is projected to be fully depleted by the year 2035. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is scary. Someone my age can't even rely on Social Security being there at all anymore. Right. Not to mention that, you know, saving $1, $2 million, which is how much money they say millennials need to retire at age 65, is $2 million. Mm-hmm. That's no easy feat, right? Like, I don't know many multimillionaires. So to think about trying to do this is very intimidating. That's why I think we need to pivot to a passive income or a cash flow model. Mm-hmm. The epiphany I had a few years ago is that once your passive income or your cash flow exceeds your living expenses, you're retired, you're financially independent. And to me, it's a lot easier to come up with $5, $6, $8,000 a month in cash flow than it is to try to save $2 million by age 65. So I think there needs to be a lot of education around this, a lot of awareness spread, because to me, this is the new way to achieve retirement.
Well, speaking of education, I mean, where can people start? Where can they turn for more resources or more information on, you know, getting started down that road?
I think there's a lot to be said for real estate investing. That's a very common way to create cash flow, to create passive income. Podcasts like Bigger Pockets and Afford Anything are excellent resources for real estate investing, but that's not the only way to generate passive income. So my book, Passive Income, Aggressive Retirement, I talk about 28 different passive income models. So trust me when I say there is something out there for everyone. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Certainly good food for thought there. What's next for you, Rachel?
There's a few things that are coming up in terms of projects. I've heard from my platform that they want more content about real estate investing. So I'll probably be launching a course this year. Maybe I'll eventually write my third book about how to start buying rental properties. And then, you know, we're just going to take the year to travel, hike, do all the fun things, have adventures. So it should be a lot of fun.
That's great. That's great. And hopefully, you know, when the pandemic's over, we can all get together and share some of those war stories in person. So.
Yes, I have a lot of them.
Listen, Rachel, it's been great talking to you. It's been a treat. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your time and insights. I really do appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for having me, Bill.
Oh, yeah. Good stuff there this week with Rachel Richards. By making the topic of money management fun, entertaining, and simple, she's helped thousands of millennials and others work their way out of financial despair. Again, really, really great conversation there. You can learn more and order her best-selling books, Money Honey and Passive Income Aggressive Retirement, at her website, which is moneyhoneyrachel.com. And don't forget, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. We're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. And that's all I got, gang. Have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.